Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation from Jersey City in downtown Jersey City, which is also in Jersey City. Oh, I had last week off, so that's my excuse. Freeform, everybody, from the great state of New Jersey. It's great to be back. Thanks so much for joining me. I was out last week, and I first of all want to say thank you so much to the great Daddy Garbage, Matt Warwick himself, who guest hosted Tectonic last week and just did another fantastic job. He's so good at hosting this show. He really is. If you didn't listen to it, you can find it in the archives at WFMU.org. Matt asked the listeners, what is the best robot? It was a very simple question, which got some really interesting responses in a call-in format, and Matt's really good at hosting a call-in show. And he's going to be on the air tomorrow morning with his regular weekly show, Garbage Time, which starts at 9 a.m. Eastern. It being a Tuesday morning, he's always on Tuesday mornings, 9 a.m. to 12 noon Eastern, and I would recommend that show to you. And he occasionally on Garbage Time will have a call-in segment, but not always. And so if you listen to last week's Tectonic, you get a full hour of Matt manning the phones. And thanks to all of you listeners for playing along and coming back with some very interesting responses. I was trying to think it wasn't what's your favorite robot, it's what's the best robot. And that's a tough one. It's a tough one for me to answer. Maybe I'll have an answer for you by the end of this show. We'll see. But speaking of questions and answers, and I'm going to get to the theme of tonight's show here in just a moment. But when I was last here 2 weeks ago, I asked the listeners to send me your questions because I still intend to do a listener questions episode. If I get enough questions, I may be able to do this next week, but I have gotten some questions from listeners. Thanks to those of you who've sent in questions already, but I need some more. I do need some more. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd really appreciate it if you enjoy the show and or if you have a burning question, pitch in to the listener questions episode as follows. Send me an email. My email is mark@wfmu.org. That's M-A-R-K at WFMU.org, and tell me what your question is. It could be, for example, it could be a question about a particular technology that you have some interest in or are curious about. It could be a question about a current news story, something that you want to hear more about or you don't understand, or if you're interested in my own take, Mark, if I haven't covered it. Or it could be a follow-up question on a previous episode. Mark, you covered X, or you interviewed person X, and what do you think about Y? Something like that. It could be just a very simple question. Anything about tech topic, tech interview, a Tectonic episode, and just email it to me at mark@wfmu.org. Just indicate if you want to remain anonymous or if not, if you want me to say your name or your first name, last name initial, or however you want. I'm happy to abide by that. If you'd particularly like to hear your voice on the radio, send me a clear audio clip with you voicing or speaking the question. And if it's good quality enough audio, I may run the audio on the show. And that also you can just email to me as an attachment. If you can do this in the next day or two, that would give me some time to prep this listener questions episode, which could be next week. Okay, so again, just send me a question, would you? mark@wfmu.org, and thanks to those of you who have already done so. All right, let's move on to tonight's episode, shall we? The theme tonight is food, and I use that word advisedly because there's an entire food industry, so-called food industry, that makes, or I should say manufactures, ultra-processed food that at some point, in my opinion, ceases to resemble food at all. It's ultra-processed, somewhat edible, extruded content, let's call it. But for shorthand for this episode, we can call it food. There is a documentary about the food industry that is recently out. It's called Food Inc. 2. Okay, and there's a link to it on the playlist at WFMU.org. I put a link to a site that'll show you where it's streaming. You can rent it from various services for a few dollars. This documentary, Food Inc. 2, is, as the title suggests, a sequel to a previous documentary called Food Inc. that came out several years ago. And both Food Inc. and Food Inc. 2 feature writers like Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, and Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation. And Food Inc. 2 features a past Tectonic guest, who's going to be our guest tonight. His name is Mark Schatzker. If you've been listening to Tectonic for a while, you'll recognize that name because Mark was on the show on December 27, 2021, talking about his book, The End of Craving. That's an interview that I really recommend. If you're interested in food, ultra-processed food, or even real food, because we talk about the real food in Northern Italy, that comes up also in this interview from December 2021 with Mark Schatzker. And we're talking about a story that he tells in The End of Craving, which is a very interesting story about a wasting away disease, fortification of food in the food system, and the rise of obesity in some countries, but not in others. So that's the Tectonic context here. Well, I saw Food Inc. 2, and there's Mark Schatzker. Mark Schatzker had some very important things to contribute to Food Inc. 2, and I thought I would love to get Mark back on the show to talk about what we've learned or not as a society since the first Food Inc. came out. And what are some of the lessons and what's going on right now with food technology? What's some of the research? And Mark's going to go over all of that in the interview. And as a bonus, and I didn't even know I was going to get this, but I'm really excited to present this to you. Yes, on Tectonic, thanks to Mark Schatzker, we're going to be presenting a short history of Doritos. Yeah, coming up, a short history of Doritos, thanks to Mark Schatzker. So I'm going to go ahead and play this interview. If we have some time afterwards, I may have some post-interview comments, as usual. And if you'd like to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlists and comments. I also have some, I hope you'll find them relevant meme-style images on the playlist for your enjoyment. And if you're listening in the future to an archive or podcast, you also can see those images and see the comments from tonight if you go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click the playlist link for June 10, 2024. Let's go ahead and listen now to my interview with Mark Schatzker, who is in the documentary Food Inc. 2, here on Tectonic on WFMU. Mark Schatzker, welcome back to Tectonic.
Thanks for having me again.
Mark, you're the author of Steak, The Dorito Effect, and The End of Craving, which you talked about on the December 27, 2021 show. And you're also the writer in residence at the Modern Diet and Physiology Research Center based at McGill University in Montreal. But I wanted to bring you back to talk about your involvement in a documentary called Food Inc. 2. This film features you as well as writers like Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser, talking about how the food system has changed since the release of an earlier film called Food Inc., which came out in 2008. Some listeners might be asking, why do we need a second documentary about our food system? Have things really changed that much in the past 15 years?
Well, it's a good question. And I think the reason is that there was so much optimism and hope and such an incredible sort of determination to fix things that you'd expect that things would have changed substantially. And I think in some ways they have, but certainly the age-old problems have not gone away. Obesity, you know, keeps getting worse. We have drugs to treat them now, which we didn't have when Food Inc., the original, came out. But the food system has probably improved in some ways, but I think it's gotten worse in other ways. And I think more importantly, our understanding of what's wrong has changed. I think has developed. We've done more research. The science is going in new directions, and I think that's part of the reason for the update.
We're doing more research, and we've learned more about what's causing some of these problems. And yet, it seems like on the corporate side, the companies have developed their technology better. Maybe we should give some examples so that listeners know what we're talking about. In the section of the documentary where you appear, it's called Where the Money Is. There is a doctor in Sao Paulo, Brazil, who talks about the decline in child malnutrition over the last number of years in parallel with an increase in obesity. What the doctor says is that traditional dishes like rice and beans have been replaced by ultra-processed foods like soft drinks, snack bars, cereals, and that sort of thing. Speaking about the development of technology by ultra-processed food companies, how is it that child malnutrition may go down even as obesity would go up?
Because I think they're two sides of the coin. Malnutrition tends to do with the undernutrition, just not having access to enough food. I'm leaning towards starvation, whereas obesity is overnutrition. It's getting too much of the nutrients in an imbalanced way. And that tends to be the story that Brazil went through. I don't want to say in fast forward, but faster than the developed world. But, you know, 100 years ago, the issue was malnutrition. There were poor kids that had diseases like rickets and pellagra, which I wrote about in The End of Craving. These were nutritional deficiencies. There were kids that didn't have enough to eat. There were kids during the Second World War that didn't have enough to eat. That has changed now. It's not impossible, but in the developed world, cases of starvation are pretty rare. People may not have predictable access to food. They can experience food insecurity, but they're not starving. We don't have anywhere near the numbers of cases of malnutrition where, you know, people might have stunted growth. But what we do have is overnutrition, which is that people are eating too much food. So it's interesting because you almost seem cursed. It's like, well, if you don't have enough to eat, you have too much to eat, and there doesn't seem to be any balance in between.
One of the things that the documentary brings up in that section is that the food companies are now targeting countries where people culturally are still habituated to eating real food. So these companies want to break into these markets to encourage them to eat more of their sugary, chemically snacks. And that seems to match a pattern that you wrote about in your book, The End of Craving, in which food companies have been fortifying their foods with things like niacin, riboflavin, and iron and other things in order to, as I read it, encourage people to eat more, not simply to stave off malnutrition. In other words, there's a real business reason why these companies with all of this fortification and chemicals are going into these countries where people eat real food because they think they're going to be able to open up a market where people are going to eat too much once they get a taste of these processed foods.
Yeah, I mean, like any company, they're seeking to increase their revenue. The market in the developed world is very mature. It's very competitive. It was a lot easier to launch Doritos in the early 1960s. I think it was 65, than it would be now, just because it's so incredibly competitive. But you can go to a country where there's really very nascent or nothing like the ultra-processed food industry that we have here. It's like, you know, tilling virgin earth. As far as the fortification goes, I don't think these food companies are aware of the connection between fortification and eating more. I think the reason they do that is to present the sheen of nutrition. They want to be able to say to anyone who's criticizing them, who say, oh, your foods are just empty calories. They'll say, no, we're fortifying them with all these important vitamins and minerals. But it also affects consumers because consumers have kind of a vague awareness of nutrition. And it's vague. Most people don't truly understand nutrition. But then they look on the packaging and they say, oh, look at all these vitamins and minerals. It must be healthy. So I think it's more of a marketing effort than anything. And I think the connection I pointed to in The End of Craving, where this is probably causing people to eat more, is something they're not completely aware of. Or if they are, they're certainly keeping those cards very close to their chest.
But there are ways that the food companies are designing their foods in order to get people to consume more, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say that would be the sensory technology, the things like not just salt and sugar, because that's just oversimplifying it, and the fat. It's things like the natural flavorings, the artificial flavorings, the umami tastings, things like MSG or Torula yeast or disodium guanylate. There are various umami triggers that the food industry has. This is what I talk about in my first book, The Dorito Effect. This was the Pandora's box of what we now call ultra-processed food, which is when we could make food taste like other stuff. And it's really interesting because the conversation has been so dominated by nutrients. We talk about carbs, we talk about fat, we talk about protein, as though we all understand, and the truth is we don't. We don't have a clue what's going on inside our bodies, how much we're eating, how much we need. We think we do, but we don't. Interestingly, the experience of food is all about flavor. Every time you sit down to have a meal, you want it to taste good. And if you're on some kind of a diet like South Beach or Atkins or carnivore, whatever, you're going to buy the cookbook that's got like, 55, can't miss super delicious recipes for this diet. Everybody wants food to taste good. And yet we never talk about how we have manipulated food to taste good. And it started with the original Doritos. Which, contrary to what most people think, didn't actually start off the way we all know and unfortunately love them. The very first Doritos were just salted tortilla chips, like the kind that you dip in salsa. And the guy who created them, it's actually quite an interesting story. He was an ad guy. He was like, he walked in off that show Mad Men. He used to be on Madison Avenue. He worked on like Jell-O puddings, and he worked in Campbell's soups. And then the Frito Company hired him to be their VP of sales and marketing and moved him down to Dallas, Texas. And then right after they merged with the Lay's chip company to become Frito-Lay. And they were selling at the time Fritos and potato chips. And so he took his family out to California in the early 60s. He was staying at the house of a guy named Lawrence Frank, who was a friend of his, who the connection that most people today would have is that he's the guy who invented Lawry's seasoned salt and Lawry's seasonings. It was an amazing trip in so many ways. He actually took his family to a restaurant called the Five Crowns, which is in Newport Beach. It's still there, still famous for its prime rib. And he had prime rib and he loved it. He loved all the fixings, the creamed spinach and the prime rib and all that. And then on his way out the door, this stranger just walks up to the family and compliments his daughter's beautiful golden hair. And they get to talking. It turns out they're both in the food industry. And this stranger said, "Well, have you heard of my restaurant?" They were opening like their 50th location or something. And they hadn't. And the guy was Ray Kroc, the McDonald's guy. So Arch West, the guy who invented Doritos, met the guy who didn't invent, but bought McDonald's and blew it up into McDonald's. They met and they passed like ships in the night. "Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you." That was the end of it. Then a couple of days later, the West family's driving down to San Diego, and they passed what Arch West's daughter described to me as this little Mexican shack. And she said, "My dad was the kind of guy, he just had to pull over and check it out." And there he bought some tortilla chips, and he bit into one, and he had this epiphany. He thought, "This is the next big thing for my new company, Frito-Lay, tortilla chips." So he goes back to headquarters in Dallas, and he pitches it, and they're just like, "What are you talking about? We already sell Fritos, which are like deep-fried cornmeal. This is just cornmeal that's baked and then cut into triangles and then deep fried. It's just maybe like a bit crunchier. It's kind of the same deal. What's going on?" So they shut it down. But he knew better. And he took some discretionary money that he was not supposed to spend, and he spent it on developing this tortilla chip concept. He gave it a name, which meant kind of a little piece of gold in a very, very bastardized pidgin Spanish. And he repitched it. And he says, "Gentlemen, I give you Doritos." And he got the green light. And the Doritos that hit the market, I think it was like 63 or 64, were just salted tortilla chips. And they bombed. They didn't sell. The complaint was, "These chips sound Mexican, but they don't taste Mexican." And so this guy Arch West is facing his fellow executives. He's essentially been shamed. I mean, this has been a total disaster. He thought he knew better. And like smack in the face, his new snack food has bombed. And they say, "What are you going to do about this?" And he says, "Let's make them taste like taco." And this got laughs. And one of the guys in the room said, "Our Yankee friend from the North doesn't know the difference between a thing and a flavor." And it was such a wonderful comment because right up until that point, that was essentially how life was. Different things had different flavors. If you wanted to eat a hot dog, buy a hot dog. If you want to eat grapes, buy some grapes. If you want to taste watermelon, get a watermelon. If you want to taste fried chicken, fry chicken. But Arch West knew Probably due to his friendship, we don't know because he's dead, but probably due to his friendship with Lawrence Frank, the Lawry seasoning guy, that you could now, there was now technology that could make, you could make something taste like whatever you wanted. And he used this technology, a combination of umami tastings like Torula yeast and flavorings, this magical word that appears in ingredient panels that we never talk about. And they created taco-flavored Doritos. And let's just think for a moment how significant this is, because all we ever do is talk about calories, sugar, carbs, fat. This is the stuff we supposedly love. Well, we didn't love it with those original Doritos. They had salt, they had carbs, they had fat. Didn't work. But then we sprinkle on this magical dusting of flavorings, which have zero calories. And suddenly, a snack that nobody was particularly interested in eating becomes a snack that people cannot stop eating. And thus was born Doritos, arguably the most successful snack food in the history of snack food. And I think that tells us so much about what we're getting wrong, because the calories are what make us fat, but what makes us eat them is something completely different. And that is this sensory technology. And that's why it's, you know, it's interesting because there's this discussion about ultra-processed foods. Everyone's freaked out. What's going on? And everyone's trying to figure out what is it about ultra-processed foods that makes them dangerous. And what I argued in the Dorito Effect, which was 2015, is that junk food is food that tastes like something that it isn't. And this is something we weren't designed for evolutionarily. We were designed to eat sugar. We have sugar receptors on our tongue. We were designed to eat fat. Our species and our ancestors have been eating fat for eons. We were not designed for a food environment where what we sense is different from what we get.
Yeah, you talk in Food Inc. too about that effect of uncertainty, that the brain is getting fooled by the food that it's sensing as it gets ingested. And you have this great analogy to someone looking at a fuel gauge. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and I'm going to expand on it. And I want to talk about, first of all, the sensory system that we have, because we tend to think that, you know, we first see food or smell it, and then we taste it, and we enjoy it. Well, we hopefully enjoy it when we taste it. And we tend to think this is all kind of frivolous. It's like some stupid thing from the Stone Age that just gets us into trouble, because it's only when the food gets in the stomach that the serious business of digestion and metabolism happens. This is not how it's really working. The reason we have the sensory system, and it's one hell of a system, like the nose and mouth are just these lightning fast, incredible chemical sensors. To buy that technology would cost you $500,000, and it would take 4 hours to get the readout. Your nose and mouth and your brain do it in a split second. And the reason is that taking in food is a challenge. It disrupts the process of the body. You can't. You know, it's interesting. If you see an F-18 flying, it can go and refuel in midair. Humans can't do that. You can't run a marathon and eat a sandwich at the same time, because we have to devote the body's resources to whatever we're doing. And the brain wants to get information. When you're smelling and tasting food, it's called the cephalic phase, where there's a secretion of insulin, which is getting ready because this food's coming in and the body has to get ready to figure out what to do with it. This business of sensing food, seeing it, smelling it, tasting it, it's just the beginning. Your brain goes on sensing food in the stomach, in the gut. It even senses whether or not glucose, for example, has been metabolized. In rodents, if you give them a drug that blocks the metabolism of glucose, they lose what's called the reinforcement of glucose. They don't want to eat it anymore. That's how suspicious your brain is. That's how information hungry the human brain is. But here's what we've done. Because we think we have a stupid brain that doesn't know what's good for it, we've created these sensory technologies, things like artificial sweeteners that taste sweet but don't deliver calories. We've developed flavorings that can make something taste like a tomato, but there's no tomato in it, none of the vitamins, none of the antioxidants. We have fat replacers that create this luscious, rich sensation in the mouth of fat, but deliver no fat. And what we do is we create this early experience of it in the mouth, but then in the gut, something else arrives. And this is what neuroscientists call reward prediction error, which is to say the brain said, I sensed sweet. I thought calories were coming. I didn't get calories. And a reward prediction error leads to the state of uncertainty. And that sounds like kind of a vague, you know, what is that word? It's a very big word in the world of psychology. There's a massive literature on it. And what is the effect of uncertainty? It enhances motivation. There's this idea that evolution sort of baked in our genes, this desire to constantly overeat. That's not true. This is something very new. But what evolution did bake into our genes is to respond to uncertainty with extra motivation. And there's a very good reason, because if something in the world that's important, like food, becomes uncertain, if there's this whisper that you might not get what you need, that leads to a loss, that leads to you're not doing as well as the other members of your pack, that leads to the possibility you might die, you might not reproduce. So our ancestors who responded to uncertainty with extra motivation were likelier to survive, to reproduce, and this is what got baked into our genes. So this is why I use the example of a fuel gauge, because if you think about it, you're driving your car and your fuel gauge says full, but you know it's off, you know the thing's broken, you have no idea how much gas is in the tank, you're going to fill your car up far more frequently than if that gauge was accurate, because you're like, I don't want to run out of gas. If I run out of gas on the highway, that's a disaster. I might miss my flight. I got to call a tow truck. I think there's all sorts of examples of uncertainty. You know, when you walk up to the elevator and someone's already pressed the up button, so you can see it's illuminated, but there's no elevator. So what do? You go and jab it again like five times. You're like, where's the stupid elevator? Even though you know it's not going to do anything, you do that. But this is the effect of uncertainty. It causes more motivation. One of the best examples is gambling. Why do we gamble? For years, scientists couldn't figure it out. Was it to gain more wealth? Well, that was kind of the theory. But then these two psychologists pointed out, well, sometimes you'll get like two rich guys will bet $10 on a football game. Now, there's no way $10 is going to make either of them meaningfully richer. And yet they engaged in it. Why is that? Because it's the uncertainty of the gamble that draws us in. That's why when we see that slot machine, you see the blackjack table, you're drawn to it. And the casinos play on this instinct that we have, and they profit from it massively, and we suffer from it. But that is the effect that uncertainty has. And this is what we've done to our food supply. This is, in my opinion, the problem with ultra-processed foods, is they fool the brain. 150 years ago, sweetness always meant calories. It was stable. Now it's not. It could mean calories on a Tuesday, it means calories. On a Wednesday, it means no calories. On a Thursday, it means some calories. On a Friday, it could mean more calories than I expected. This is not what we were designed for.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Mark Schatzker, who appears in the documentary Food Inc. 2, talking about the effects of ultra-processed foods on the human body and the involvement with our brains, as Schatzker was just pointing out. We also heard a short history of Doritos that I think was covered in more detail in the Dorito Effect, Mark's book. Mark was on the show back in December 2021 talking about The End of Craving, another one of his books. And just an interesting guy, as I think you can hear. And I'd recommend going back and listening to that previous interview if you're interested to hear more from him. We're having a good conversation on the discussion board at WFMU.org. Click playlists and comments to join in. Let's now hear the rest of my interview with Mark Schatzker here on Tectonic on WFMU. I want to talk about a study run at Yale that was mentioned in Food Inc. 2, and this had to do with what you're talking about, sweetness matching calories or not. Can you describe that study?
It's a great study, and it was performed by Dana Small, a neuroscientist. She was at Yale. She's now moved to McGill University, and I actually work with Dana at the Modern Diet and Physiology Research Center. So this is a study I know really well. And Dana was approached by Pepsi, and they wanted to know, was it possible to create beverages that had fewer calories but were just as rewarding, which is to say, just as desirable, people like them just as much? So it comes down to two things. It's either the sweetness that people like, or it's the calories. So basically the brain is either saying, I just like sweetness, or the brain's saying, you know, actually I do some extra work here. And after I drink it, I do this analysis and it's the calories I like. So to test this question, Dana created five drinks, and she used the artificial sweetener sucralose so that they all tasted identically sweet, as though they had about 80 calories worth of sweetness. She then used a tasteless starch called maltodextrin to give each drink a different payload of calories. So one drink had no calories, one drink I think had 37.5, one had 80, one had 100 or something, one had like 140. I might be getting those numbers slightly wrong. And then she let subjects drink the drinks. They all had the kind of a distinct color and flavor. And so over time, their brains would get to know the drinks. And she then brought them in and put them in the fMRI. This is this brain scanner that scans the brain, and she lets them have the drinks. So let's ask ourselves, before this happens, what's going to happen? Well, you'd think, well, there's either going to be one of two results. Either the brain is just interested in sweetness and the underlying calories have nothing to do with it, in which case all the drinks are going to be equally rewarding. Or the brain's gonna be like, nah, I did my analysis. It's that 140 calorie drink because I'm a calorie monger. And what came back was really weird. It was the 80 calorie drink. And Dana Small at this point was pretty sure she screwed it up because this made no sense. She did it again. It happened again. This was odd. And then it dawned on her. What was going on is the drink that was most rewarding was where the calories matched the sweetness, which is to say, the drink that tasted like it had 80 calories and actually had 80 calories is the one that was the most rewarding. So then she did a further analysis. She put subjects in what's called an indirect calorimeter. This is a device that uses, it analyzes your breath to measure what's called the thermic effect of food. So when you consume calories, you burn calories to digest, to process, metabolize those calories, and this can be measured through heat. And so one day she brings in a subject, and the subject drinks the 80 calorie drink, goes into the indirect calorimeter, and there's this just beautiful plume of heat, exactly what the textbooks tell you to expect. Everything's going great. A few days later, the subject comes in and drinks the 140 calorie drink. The response is flat. The response is like she drank a glass of water, even though she just had a boatload of calories. This is really interesting, and this is actually really frightening because what it revealed is that when there's this mismatch between what the brain senses and what the brain gets, those calories don't get metabolized properly. We don't actually, at this point, even really know what happens to those calories. We think they get turned into fat. And this is disturbing because it tells us that the sensory attributes of food, how it tastes, how sweet it is, and so forth, it's more than skin deep. This is important information the brain relies on to help it metabolize food. And when we fool it, we're not winning, we're losing.
You mentioned that that study was funded by Pepsi. There was a mention in the documentary about Pepsi executives claiming that they didn't understand the results. Can you say more about the fallout of what happened there?
Yeah, there was a huge fallout. Pepsi basically said, this is nonsense. This makes no sense. And they pulled the funding. And this kind of frustrated Dana for a long time because she thought they didn't know what they were doing. And then later, I think she felt that they did know what they were doing because they can't know, they can't have knowledge that their products are making people sick. So it's essentially, see no evil, hear no evil. I think the idea is they didn't want to know about this research because that put many of their products in a suspect light.
It's so familiar to me, that kind of response. Often the show I'm talking about digital technology firms, not so much food technology, but the parallels are there. For example, when research a few years ago came to light from inside Facebook, run by Facebook researchers, suggesting that Instagram usage was having harmful effects on teenage girls, the response from Facebook Meta executives was, let's bury it, let's ignore it. Let's keep doing what we're doing and not pay too much attention to those effects. Because as you say, if the company leadership acknowledges the harms that their product is creating, then that calls into question the entire enterprise. That was something that came across to me as I watched Food Inc. 2, that again and again through the various sections of the film, we're seeing the reactions of corporations wanting to pursue growth at any cost and ignoring the health effects, both to individuals and to our society at large.
Yeah, it reminds me of an experience I had when I was researching the Dorito effect. I met a flavorist who was flavoring a children's cereal and trying to come up with a more authentically chocolate taste. And they're really good at it. I tasted kind of the before and after, and it was really amazing how they could evoke this chocolatey experience without using any chocolate at all, which is also great because it turns out it's really cheap to do that. Although there's a negative because chocolate actually has some good stuff in it. antioxidants and so forth. But then I said to them, I said, you know, do you think this kind of technology in which you make food taste better is contributing to the obesity epidemic? And they said, oh, you know, not really. You know, portion size is a personal choice. And I thought, you know, that's very convenient to think that way. The truth is it's not. Because if it really were, there would be no obesity unless somebody wanted to be that way, because they just simply say, oh, I'll just have a smaller portion. We know it doesn't work. We know it can't work that way. But industry can't face that because it would really change the way they do business. It would upend everything.
I wonder if we could talk about some of the other sections in the film. There's one called Get Big or Get Out that also seemed to parallel some things that we're seeing in the digital tech industry. Michael Pollan is talking about these giant dairy farms in relatively dry states of California and Arizona. These dairy farms have moved there apparently because of the lack of regulation, instead of being in Midwestern states that have more water naturally occurring. And what's happening in these dry states is that the dairy farms are draining the water table. And there are these towns near these giant dairy farms that are running out of water. And it reminded me so much of data centers that these technology companies are putting up all over the U.S., often in these small communities. They build the data center without sharing the details of the deal with the citizens beforehand. There's some sort of NDA. And by the time the citizens know that this data center is in town, it's too late to do anything about it. And you know what consumes a lot of water in addition to giant dairy farms? Data centers.
Yeah.
So what's the future of our dairy production in this country if it's draining the water?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, it's livestock agriculture. I'm not against livestock agriculture. My first book was about steak. I love dairy products. I love cheese. I love ice cream. But I think we have to ask how it is that we raise the animals that provide us with this, I think, very nutritious and obviously very delicious food, which is part of our cuisine. It's part of our tradition. And I think if we continue on this trajectory that we're on, we're, you know, because they talk about things like cellular meat, growing meat in a vat. And I think, well, what's the difference? If you're just pushing these animals, you've got them in these factories and you're shoving nutrients down their gullets in order to extract, whether it's milk or meat or whatever, from them, what's the difference? I think there is a humane and I think an environmentally responsible way to raise livestock. We just have to incentivize farmers to do that. And we have to, I think there has to be a penalty against these kinds of really, truly intensive forms of raising them. Otherwise, there's just too much of an incentive to do it. This is something I've thought a lot about, and it's strange because I don't think anyone actually wants this. I think this is an outcome. I don't even know how to describe it, but from the point of view of these meat companies or dairy companies, every time a consumer buys something on sale or buys the lower priced item, they're sending a signal that says, I want it to be cheaper. So then let's say in the case of the dairy company, they're saying, well, we're getting pretty strong signals from the marketplace that consumers want their milk or their yogurt or ice cream to be even cheaper. What do we do? Well, it turns out if we want to be even more efficient, you know, a herd of 400 dairy cows is too small. Even 4,000 is too small. We got to get to like 14,000. So the person buying that cheaper milk doesn't actually want that to happen. They're not saying, you know, what I really want you guys to do is to open a massive dairy in the middle of the desert and drain the aquifer. Nobody wants that. But it's kind of a perverse place that the market arrives at.
Yeah. And this gets to the necessity of regulation. I mean, companies are following the signals from consumers. Consumers are following whatever's on offer from the companies. And it becomes a race to the bottom unless you have a third party, in this case, the government, acting as referee and saying, no, actually, we're not going to, I don't know how you would write a regulation for dairy farms, but something that says we're not going to drain the water from the Arizona aquifers in order to dip the price of milk and cheese just a little bit more. But then there's another issue, which is once the regulations are in place, are the companies actually following those regulations?
And it's also very difficult to write regulations because there can be unforeseen consequences. Sometimes you can create perverse incentives that you didn't see in advance. But I would also say there's another approach to this, which is that I think there's also what we also need to think about is changing consumer behavior. You know, I wrote a lot about in my book, The Dorito Effect, a lot about chickens and how much chicken has changed. In 1948, a chicken like a 3.5 pound chicken was probably 14 weeks old. So now you'll get like a 5 pound chicken, which is 7 weeks old. We've just absolutely tremendously accelerated the rate of chicken growth. They don't spend time outside anymore. We sort of have this idea of chickens clucking around the farm. That doesn't happen. Even if they're so-called free range, that's not happening. But interestingly, you can look at different markets. In France, they have what's called a La Belle Rouge chicken. And this started out in the 1950s when chickens started to change. A lot of French people, including farmers, said, "Hey, something's happening to chicken. It's getting plumper and bigger, but it's losing flavor." So they sort of set in stone this standard for how to raise chickens the old-fashioned way called La Belle Rouge. Red label is all it means, red label chicken. And these are chickens that it takes 84 days to a minimum of 84 days to reach maturity, as opposed to like 35 or 40 or 42. They have to have access to the outside and they have to have a lower energy diet. And it's a very different chicken. It's a chicken that is still flavorful, that has leads more of a kind of a life that we think of as a chicken life. And it's an interesting question. Why would the French do this and not North Americans? I've looked in the cookbooks. You can see in 1962, Julia Child, she said that the modern chickens look plump and delicious, but they taste like teddy bear stuffing. I found in one edition of The Joy of Cooking, a kind of a meditation saying on how chickens losing flavor. I found another, I'm trying to remember the author, I can't remember, but she wrote about how chicken was losing its flavor. And then I think a more recent cookbook, I found it just said chicken's like pasta, it's a blank slate, which is like this acknowledgement, it's lost its flavor. The French are not wealthier than we are. GDP per capita is higher in the United States than it is in France. So it's not as though they just got all this money to spend. They care more about the flavor and the quality of the food they eat. And this isn't just a class issue here, because I see all sorts of people driving, high-end imported cars, buying the cheapest chicken available. They say, I went to Costco and I got this great deal. And it's weird because it's like, well, you buy nice clothes, you drive a nice car, but you buy the cheapest food money can buy. And that is actually like it's going in your mouth, down the gullet, into your body. And we just have this strange relationship with food. I can understand for people that are struggling with income, this is a challenge. But we have a ton of disposable income. There's lots of families with three, four cars, two homes, lots of lavish vacations. Let's buy the cheapest food money can buy. Everybody buys the high-end iPhone, but the low-end food. It's strange to me. And in other cultures, we see the French, Italians, the Japanese, South Koreans, they care more about the quality of their food and they spend more on it. And interestingly, they eat less of it. And everyone's going to say, well, maybe we can't afford to. And all I will say is the metabolic disease, diabetes, obesity, it costs us billions of dollars. So it might cost you a little more in the short run. We would save money in the long run if we cared more about the quality of our food.
You write very lyrically in The End of Craving about the food culture in Bologna and Emilia-Romagna, the province around Bologna. People take their pasta very seriously in Emilia-Romagna, and there are some local regulations about what is allowed to be called a certain kind of pasta, right?
Yes, this is really important because we have this idea that food is just too darn delicious and that's why we eat too much of it. Well, if that were true, you'd expect the northern Italians, especially the residents of Bologna, to be the fattest in the world because, Italy is this amazing country. No matter where you go, they have these regional authentic food traditions that are fantastic. But Emilia-Romagna, and specifically Bologna, it's like the epicenter. They really take their food seriously. They have a chamber of commerce where there is a repository of official recipes. So if you want to make tortellini and brodo, well, you've got to make the brodo with like a farmhouse rooster or a capon, like a chicken that's been outside eating this green stuff, because that tastes better. It's going to make a better broth. If you want to make lasagna, this is the official recipe. They take it so seriously that they say there is a certain way you must do this. And Italians do this all the time. We talk about Parmesan cheese. They call it their Parmigiano Reggiano. And only certain cheese, it's got to be certain cow, and it can't eat grains. It's got to only eat hay or grass. Got to be from this region. Only then can it be called Parmigiano Reggiano. The San Marzano tomatoes. Only certain kind of tomatoes, grown in a certain area. So it kind of seems cute and funny to us. We think all those crazy Italians, but we love to travel there. We love to eat there. And the food is so incredibly good. And what's so interesting about this Chamber of Commerce in Bologna, their favorite noodle is called the tagliatelle noodle, tagliatelle in plural. It's like the size of a fettuccine, but it's made with eggs and flour, carbs and fat. We've been screaming, worried about these two deadly nutrients. this noodle is made from those two things we've been, you know, fearful of since the mid 80s. And they have a perfect version cast in gold. This is like the ideal platonic exquisite noodle. So the food's incredible. I mean, Italy is the number one country in the world that people visit for food and drink. Their food is, I think, objectively delicious. And if deliciousness were the problem, you'd expect them to be the fattest. Here's what's so amazing. The rate of obesity, last time we checked in the United States, 42%. That was prior to the pandemic. It's no doubt gotten worse. In Northern Italy, it's less than 10%. So they're eating incredible food and they have a wonderful relationship. So it's kind of baffling on the one hand. You're like, how can this be possible? And yeah, it's also very exciting because it's like, okay, actually, there is a way out of this. There actually is a way to eat food and enjoy it and not be a death sentence.
Well, there's a culture of eating and appreciating good, real food. There are regulations down to showing the platonic ideal in gold as to what the food should be. And the food itself does the things that we've been talking about, matching the calories to the sweetness and so on.
It's real food, exactly. They don't have a golden Dorito. They have a golden pasta. And then they talk about how to make the sauce. And the sauce has real ingredients. And I think that's the difference. You know, people say, well, what should I do? And I say, well, it's simple, really. Eat like an Italian. Eat real food. Celebrate the products of the land and the sea. Every meal is an opportunity to indulge in the deliciousness that this world has provided for us. Now, that's easier said than done because, you know, then you go to the supermarket and the pork we raise is so intensively raised and bred that they actually have to add flavorings to it because it's so bland. Now, listen, it's not all doom and gloom. I think things can improve. The craft beer movement's a great example of a food that's been improved. The beer we drank 30 years ago flat out sucked. It all tasted like Bud Light. Now there's a whole world. I mean, way too many to count. There's just some awesome craft beers out there. So we can fix this and we can win with deliciousness, but it's like a battle. You got to fight for it.
And a good place to start would be watching this documentary that you appear in, Mark. The documentary is called Food Inc. 2, and it's got really helpful diagnosis of the problems we face and some reason for hope. I'm leaving this conversation inspired once again, Mark. I appreciate you being on the show. Mark Schatzker, don't be a stranger.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me again.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 8 minutes and 43 seconds. And then Dave Mandel, to whom no one holds a candle, will come in with his show, It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. And the evening goes on from there. Bad animals and so on. I hope you will stay tuned to this great radio station beyond this show. It's worth your time. I also want to say thanks to Mark Schatzker for returning to Tectonic to talk about Doritos and revisit his book, The End of Craving, and, of course, to talk about his appearance in the documentary Food Inc. 2, which I would recommend to all of you. It's well done, and it has a number of different perspectives on the food industry right now, with a special emphasis on ultra-processed foods and what it's doing to our bodies, our brains, our waistlines, our water sources, our workers as a whole. There's a whole piece on labor. And it's a good overview of what's happening right now. And the movie ends with some good news. I know from experience putting together Tectonic, sometimes you struggle after, you know, 45 minutes of very challenging, not to say depressing. Okay, let's say depressing news on technology to think about something. How can I leave the listeners with some good news? And clearly the producer, the director and producers of Food Inc. 2 tried to do that. And they show you some interesting new projects and new initiatives that are trying to do things differently and that are more ethical, more healthy, and more environmentally conscious. So take a look at that documentary, and when you see Mark Schatzker, you could say, I heard him on Tectonic. And in fact, you've heard him twice. There's a link to his previous interview on the playlist at WFMU.org. The other thing I wanted to say about my reaction to Food Inc. 2 was, and I brought this up during the interview, all the parallels I saw between the food industry and the tech industry. And in some way, we can say that ultra-processed food is a technology. So just on its own merits, it belongs on the show as a discussion. But beyond that, just the parallels between what's happening with, as we were talking about, you know, the research that Pepsi at first funded, or what's happening with Doritos making, you know, Frito-Lay making an ultra-processed food product that looks like one thing but tastes like another thing, as Mark said. Those are technologies. And here you have a food industry that, did you notice that it's getting concentrated? The monopolies and duopolies, depending on the product type, the food industry is rolling up companies to make these conglomerates, much like in the tech industry, things are conglomerating into these monopolies that collectively we call big tech. And so at the very end of the movie, Michael Pollan, who's the author of Omnivore's Dilemma, and he appears a number of times in Food Inc. 2, he gives his three suggestions for what we can do to make food better. And see if these sound somewhat familiar to you if you've listened to Tectonic. One, end subsidies. Well, this one not so much for big tech, but end subsidies on corn and soy. Number two, better regulation, which we talk about a lot in the show. And number three, antitrust. So two of the three suggestions are exactly the same as what the tech industry needs in order to make better technology. So whether it's food or technology, we need more regulation and we need better antitrust efforts. And I'm happy to say on the tech side, Lena Khan is doing an excellent job, and I hope, and so is the DOJ. I hope that those efforts continue to bring the big tech giants to heel with some real antitrust efforts. One more thing I wanted to play for you very quickly. It's just a minute and a half. This I felt was relevant. This is it's a skit from Saturday Night Live from, I think, 2012. And it has something that you, I think, will enjoy hearing. This stars Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. Here it is.
Pizza. I didn't hear the delivery guy pull up.
That's because it's not delivery.
Really?
And it's not exactly pizza either. It's almost pizza.
Come on, that's pizza.
Nope, it's very nearly pizza, but not quite. It's almost pizza. See? Come on, let's eat.
So it's tofu pizza or something like that.
No, you could put tofu on a pizza and still legally call it pizza. But don't call this pizza. It's almost pizza. Pizza that's practically pizza in every way, except for a few key ones. Come on, dig in.
But it's food, though, right?
Come on!
Pizza! Nice one, Mom!
Okay, hang on here. What exactly is this, Carol?
It looks like pizza.
It's meant to.
But it's not. If it was pizza, it would just say pizza.
Look, I'll eat some.
Sure smells like pizza.
That was their intention.
Whose?
Just try it, Tom. It's getting cold.
No, if anything, it's getting hotter. Okay, what is this, Carol?
Just eat some.
Hell no!
I'll eat it.
No! What the
f***? I never said it was pizza.
If it's almost dinner, it's almost time for almost pizza. The thing that's much like pizza, roughly speaking. From Pfizer.
Okay, that's almost pizza from Saturday Night Live. We're just about out of time, friends. Thank you so much for joining me. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Remember, friends, send me your questions for the listener questions episode, mark@WFMU.org. And your other homework is to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And you know what? Get off TikTok as well, because you know why? Because it's frying your brain. Have a great week, everybody.
TikTok is frying my brain. I just can't concentrate. YouTube videos are so long. Right, you've got 3 seconds to keep me engaged.
Hey there, friends, and welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour, 60 minutes of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm Dave Mandel, your host here, doing this for you every Monday evening between the hours of 7 and 8. Thanks for joining me. I'm going to begin tonight's show with a wild track from a group called NMO. This, I should mention before I forget, was introduced and was brought to my attention by DJ Bryce here at FMU. DJ Bryce is taking the summer off. I'm very sad about that. I hope he'll be back in the fall. That also leads me into the side note that our summer season began today, June 10th, and runs through the summer, through early September, and the schedule, as usual, has various minor changes. Some people have taken the summer off. Some people have moved to different spots, different slots on the schedule. There are some new faces, new voices. Anyway, check out our schedule on our website, WFMU.org. And back to what I was saying, Bryce is one of the people taking the summer off. I'm sorry to say. As I said, I hope he'll be back in the fall. But he introduced me to this track. And again, it's by a group called NMO. And I don't know much about these guys. They foiled every effort I made to find out more about them. Actually, at a certain point, I figured, you know, they just don't want us to know. And I'm going to respect that. But the group, the name of the group is NMO. And period M period O period. But I've seen 2, 3, 5 more representations of what NMO stands for, and I think they're all just red herrings. Like the album I'm going to play the track from has two titles: Nordic Mediterranean Organization and Numerous Miscommunications Occur. And there are other NMOs sprinkled around in their work. So NMO, and appropriately enough, this is a really tricky piece. It's strictly speaking, it's an 11/8 time, which is already a fairly tricky time signature, but they basically throw hurdles in your path, and keeping the beat is virtually impossible because there's all these other instruments playing, messing up, playing in four different time signatures, different in beats and things. So it's kind of nerve-wracking if you want to try to keep track of where the beat is, but of course, kind of cool. So this is a track called New Bulgaria from NMO, mainly in 11/8 time, but with all kinds of other lunatic stuff going on. Enjoy.
New Bulgaria.